Now streaming on SBS On Demand. The Hospital in the Deep End. Our hospitals are under pressure like never before.
Oh my God.
And when the system buckles, we all pay the price.
That's not good.
In this landmark series, three notable Australians step onto the front line to see what it really takes to save a life.
I honestly didn't think it was like that.
The Hospital in the Deep End. Stream now on SBS On Demand. This is The Guardian.
I'm Jo Tovey, and this is the Full Story Newsroom Edition, where we take you behind the news of the week. Now, the Iran conflict has dominated the headlines again this week, and there's a lot to get into, so we have a full house today. With me this week is Mike Tisha.
Hi, Jo.
Gabrielle Jackson.
Hi, Jo. Another easy topic.
And as he's been covering this rapidly moving story all week, we also have senior reporter Ben Doherty here with us as well.
G'day, Jo. Thanks for having me.
As the second week of the US and Israel's war with Iran draws to a close, with no end in sight, no clear plan for regime change, and civilian deaths mounting, any suggestion that Australia's involvement would be limited to in-principle support has evaporated. Last Friday, The Guardian and other media outlets reported three Australians were on the US submarine that torpedoed an Iranian warship, killing 87 people. On Tuesday, the government confirmed we would send surveillance aircraft, missiles, and personnel to the United Arab Emirates. Now, the government says that our involvement here is defensive. It's not offensive. But let's cut through that. Are we at war with Iran?
Yes, we are at war with Iran. And I do get this sort of these rhetorical contortions that the government is sort of bending itself into. But I think it's really an act of sophistry to pretend we're not. We are sending weapons, we are sending material, we're sending troops to the UAE to assist. As you discussed, there were three submariners who were Australians on board the US nuclear submarine, which sank an Iranian warship. Australia plays a role in Pine Gap through intelligence and targeting information, which is coming through there. Australia plays a role in building the F-35s that have been at the forefront of the bombardment. So to pretend that we're somehow inoculated from this by virtue of geographic distance or by some sort of rhetorical flourish, I think is misleading. We are at war.
Yeah, I think there's been quite a few articles sort of going into the technical notions of what it means to be at war. I think that's less important than the sort of perception and the reality of what we're doing. Like we need to keep it in perspective. Like obviously we're not at war in the sense that the US and Israel are at war. We're not literally dropping bombs on Iran. But in our rhetoric, we've been very supportive of that. And we're trying to be sort of half in, but not really. Yeah. I don't think that really cuts it, to be honest. We should be clear about what we are doing, and that is quite a lot.
I think there is a process question here about how we've ended up engaged in this conflict without any real public debate, without any sort of parliamentary oversight. And all of a sudden, Australian troops with Australian money are part of this conflict. I think in lots of ways, Australia was left in a really difficult situation in that we are an ally of the US. We have signed up to AUKUS, all of these things. Increasingly over years, we've become enmeshed in the US military industrial complex. So for us to sort of withdraw from that immediately when this war suddenly breaks out would have been a very difficult thing. But it does feel a little like the UK, a little like France. We're part of this sort of coalition of the reticent. We're being sort of dragged into this unwillingly.
There are 20,000 Australians in the United Arab Emirates, and the government has been pretty careful to say that's the reason we're sending these defensive air-to-air missiles and aircraft to protect Australians and other civilians in the United Arab Emirates. But the UK and France being dragged in has also been interesting. You know, Keir Starmer was quite clear in the beginning, we're not going to let the US use our bases. Then once Cyprus was attacked, they were kind of in a position where they had to say, all right, well, maybe you can use our bases. And that is, again, different from Australia, you know, being so far away.
I just want to return to the point about the government's rhetoric here. They have not been using the term war. They are drawing a clear distinction between defensive and offensive actions. Just, Ben, based on the experts that you've talked to this week about this question, is there a legal distinction, a meaningful distinction between being involved in an offensive or a defensive capacity?
Legally not, no. Australia is involved in this conflict and, you know, as we talked about, we are contributing to it. We are helping that effort on one side. So we are a part of the war. The distinction, it's kind of a distinction without a difference between this offensive and defensive in legal terms. It has, I suppose, political utility, but in a legal sense, no.
Just on the sort of rhetoric of the government, it does feel like they're constantly walking a real tightrope when they talk about this. What do you think the way that the government has approached this conflict says about public perceptions or potential public perception of this action, and also about our relationship with the US at this time?
I mean, weighing up all kinds of things, and it's almost an impossible conundrum. I mean, they are in a difficult position, as other countries who are allied with the US are. And the difficulty is, obviously, they don't want to antagonise the US government. But on the other hand, I don't think it's particularly popular among the Australian public that we get further involved in the conflict. And there are large currents even within the Labor Party, although they've been very quiet so far, that would oppose the war. And not only within the Labor Party either, obviously, to their left, but also in the population more broadly, I think. So the problem I have with their response is the lack of transparency. Right? Mm. They had to have it kind of wheedled out of them that there were, in fact, service people on board the submarine, for example. Also, the unwillingness to confront the legality of the war, outsourcing that to the US and Israel is kind of... come on, you can look at the facts and make a judgment on that, and you should do.
And other countries even who support the war have done that. Mark Carney in Australia last week freely said it was an illegal action, but he said, you know, in the broader context, they reluctantly supported
France
it.
France and Britain have also said that.
Just on the Submariners question, Ben, you reported that story and were chasing, I think, a tip-off that you got that there were Australians on board. Can you just tell us how difficult it was to get confirmation of that and whether that is unusual in the context of reporting on defence matters like this?
In a way, the Australian government revealed this information without intending to. Earlier on, Australia had been talking about its cooperation in AUKUS, the fact that we had Australian submariners serving on US nuclear submarines. We had admirals turning up to estimates saying, you know, we've got more than 50, we're going to have more than 100 on board these boats. We had the Navy at one point putting out a press release saying 1 in 10 crew members on a US nuclear submarine was Australian, which alerted us to the fact that it was likely that there were Australians there. We started talking to people, we started ringing people who we thought we might know, and we were trying to sort of work out which US submarine it might have been. We think it's probably the USS Minnesota. You kind of work backwards from what's the likely scenario there. But again, I think to Mike's point, people need confidence and they need to trust their governments in times of war.
Look, I think they are in a bit of a difficult position, and it's very clear that they don't want to be seen to be supporting the war, even though they are, because everyone remembers the disasters of Iraq and Libya and what's happened in Syria. Australians can see very clearly that regime change wars do not work and how dangerous the war in Iraq made the rest of the country. Mm. You know, we all paid the price for that with increased terrorism, with the rise of ISIS. It is incredibly unpopular. Penny Wong was very clear and fast to get out and say, we are not the Howard government, this is not Iraq, and we're all left to work out for ourselves that we are in a limited combat operation. Mm. I don't know if you saw the New Yorker cartoon of the Tolstoy
book. Special military operation.
instead of war and peace, it says special military operation and peace, no. Tolstoy. But, you know, that's where we are.
Yeah.
Thanks, Gab. Got the Tolstoy reference.
I thought there was an interesting observation you made this morning in news conference, Gabs, about the sort of reaction to this among the parliament being further evidence of kind of left-right dichotomies breaking down. Mm. The fact that only kind of opposition we've seen to this in the parliament is from on the left, where you might expect it from the Greens, but also Matt Canavan saying that he was very suspicious of, you know, foreign entanglements in the Middle East, echoing some of that sentiment you see from the kind of Trump MAGA base, which are also very kind of anti-war elements of them in their own way.
Mm, I think that this conflict is the best example we have of how left and right no longer means anything, really, when we're talking about politics. There are so many ways that the electorate is splitting and they can't be neatly defined anymore. And I think the fact that Matt Canavan, who has very conservative views on abortion, on climate change, and was a fierce opponent to The Voice, for example, is suddenly on the same page as some leftists. I think it's an interesting thing that we need to think about.
It's just another point here, which is about the specific relationship with the UAE. In September last year, Anthony Albanese was in UAE signing a strategic partnership where the leaders reaffirmed their shared commitment to peace and stability, emphasising the importance of diplomacy in resolving conflicts and the need to respect sovereignty and uphold international law. I'm not sure how that is working out, but more to the point, I'm not quite sure why we are making such a close relationship with the UAE. It's not a democracy, obviously. It has limited freedom of speech, especially if you're one of the 90% of the population who are migrant workers there. It's been implicated in horrific war crimes in Sudan, particularly. It's also been involved in Yemen. I'm not sure it's a great actor that we should be getting close to.
I also think the other element in that is the UAE is a huge customer for Australian weapons. We've sold them $300 million worth of weapons in the last 5 years. They are by far our biggest customer. That is undoubtedly part of this.
I didn't even realise until this week that we already had some military presence in the UAE.
Mm. And we've also had retired generals go and serve in their military.
And if we're really worried about women's rights, the women who live in the United Arab Emirates do not have rights. Let's not forget the princesses who were locked up for years and now they're our ally who we're going to defend.
Well, that brings us to another topic I want to discuss this week. And we saw the war filtering into politics in another way, and that was through this incredible drama around the Iranian women's football team. We know seven members of that team applied for asylum, one since changed their mind. But the politics of this, apart from the sort of the incredible drama, the politics of this were really interesting. There was so much media and political pressure across the spectrum, really, but particularly from the coalition and from News Corp to support these women's bid for asylum. And I do think the whole country was really behind them and rooting for their safety. But were you surprised, Gabrielle, at how the politics of this played out?
I was more surprised by the media than the politics, I guess. I have to say, I think Tony Burke actually handled the situation quite well. It has become apparent that he was quietly arranging attempts to speak to the women away from their minders to offer them assistance without telling the world about it and without putting it in the front page. And I think he was doing that to protect those women who decided to stay as much as to protect the women who decided to go home.
Actively keeping it off the front page is, yes, in fact like trying to sort of really run bed on stories.
Yeah, and that's why I found some of the coverage quite distasteful in the end. I think that there was an element of white saviour complex to some of the coverage, and I think there's two points that I would kind of like to make about that. The first is that these women showed incredible courage and bravery. They decided not to sing the national anthem live on television, and that was an act that they will have to live with for the rest of their life. They didn't need, you know, white men coming to save these oppressed women. Of course, women in Iran are oppressed, but Iran is a country full of contradictions and nuances. You know, they have among the most educated women in the world, you know. And I think that brings me to my second point. Some of the coverage seemed to indicate that this was a really easy decision to make, that, of course, in war, you would not want to return to your country. But these are young women who have, like, very high cultural standing at home. They're on their national team and they are having to make a decision to leave their family and friends and everyone they love to stay in a strange country. And I don't think that that would be an easy decision at all. And we had a really great column this week by two Iranian expats, Shiva Mokri and Munez Mansoubi, who wrote, "It's important not to romanticise what they're going through. Seeking refuge is rarely a triumphant moment. It comes with grief, uncertainty, and the painful possibility of a long separation from home." So I don't think these women deserve to be used as pawns in some kind of propaganda war. I think that it was not the left, it was not the right who saved them. I think they saved themselves.
Yeah, I think the most striking thing for me about the coverage was the very sharp about turn compared with previous rhetoric on what we think about refugees in general and Iranian refugees in particular. Ben's obviously done a heap of reporting over more than a decade on refugees who we sent to Manus Island and Nauru, very many of whom were Iranian and were escaping Iran for the same reasons that the women footballers felt they needed to remain outside the country. And, yeah, that change in tone was quite stark.
Fatima Lamidi, who wrote another column for us that I highly recommend to listeners this week, she's on a bridging visa. She was sent to Nauru, escaping that same oppressive regime that we're now so happy to, you know,
we
be bombing
away. We can be very
away.
Selective in who we choose to lionize at times.
Mm. I'm glad you raised that Fatima Lamidi piece, Gabs, because I thought she raised another important point apart from just pointing out that hypocrisy between the way that these women have been treated and women and other Iranians like her have been treated over decades in Australia. She also pointed to the fact that the laws that the Albanese government introduced into Parliament this week will make it even harder for families like hers to visit Australia at the moment. These are the changes that would give the minister the power to bar temporary visa holders from entering the country. That was introduced into the Parliament the same day that Tony Burke was pictured smiling with the members of the Iranian women's team. Is there a bit of hypocrisy at work here? What do you guys think?
I mean, I thought it was pretty breathtaking to draw it on the exact same day. And yeah, I have heard that sort of discussed as hypocrisy, and it's hard to see it as anything else. This legislation coming before the parliament to be debated as we're welcoming these five and ultimately seven women. I mean, I think the measure we need to be asking is, you know, are more people who need protection, who need to be safe, getting that protection? And I think the answer to this is we're doing the opposite.
Last week we talked about how the grim reality is that it could be the economic fallout of this conflict that is the thing that really bites the Labor government in Australia, and it might even be the thing that gets Trump to pull back on this offensive. In Australia, we've already seen petrol prices rising. There's talk of fuel shortages. How worried do you think the government is about these trends, and do you think it will have any impact on the plans for the upcoming budget?
I think they're obviously very worried about it. They will be keen for it to be as short-term as possible. All of the factors, all of the economic fallout from the war seems to play into all the grievances that have fueled populism in this and other countries, and also fueled the upsurge in support for One Nation, I think, as it has in other countries. So from that point of view, I think they'll be very worried. The temptation for Labor is to think, well, if we just keep steady as she goes, we can coast to repeated election victories, getting 30 to 35% of the vote. I think that would be incredibly dangerous if they were thinking like that, even subconsciously. And I think they need to be much more active in attacking these very problematic issues, which have only been sharpened by everything that's happening in the war.
Yeah, Gabs, there did seem to be promising signs that this government was really focused on the idea of intergenerational inequality before this conflict began. We've seen stories about, you know, potential modellings of changes to the capital gains tax discount. Do you think, though, that they could back away from some of that ambition because of what's going on?
I think they could, judging by what they've done in this term and the last term so far. I think they shouldn't. I think that this moment provides even more impetus for bold and ambitious change. Shane Wright wrote a really good column in the Sydney Morning Herald this week about why this is the most important budget of the century. And I don't think this moment of global uncertainty changes any of those reasons. There is an electorate who is incredibly hungry for change and for bold action by government. You know, this war doesn't change the intergenerational inequality that currently exists. And I think the huge majority they have in parliament, added to this moment of global uncertainty, is why they should do something at home right now and make that part of their legacy.
Joe, I find myself in fierce agreement with both Mike and Gabs. You know, and to
that's
all,
not what was supposed to happen on a
to
podcast.
To all the subjects we covered today, you know, look, it speaks to the Australian government's sort of commitment to managerialism rather than leadership. I do think this is a time for sort of bold action. You know, people talk about, you know, politics as the art of the possible sort of thing. But I do think that longer-term vision, as Gab says, like, this is a moment to grab that now.
I think at times like this, like, people need hope, and there is going to be no hope by just steady as she goes. You know, a bold vision. I think Jim Chalmers is an incredibly good communicator. If Albanese trusted him, I think that he is one person in the government who could get out there and argue for a change that the country needs.
And now we turn to the things we can't get out of our head this week. Gabrielle, what was it for you?
Mine is this campaign called Resist and Unsubscribe, which Scott Galloway, the American writer, started in February. And I've been thinking about, oh, is that really going to make a difference, you know? But I do like the idea that in times of, you know, terrible, terrible world events, and as we feel like AI is taking out of our lives, there are little acts of resistance that we can do. And Rutger Bregman was on Today in Focus this week arguing for the more specific campaign called Quit GPT. And he gave such a rousing argument of why unsubscribing from ChatGPT was an incredibly meaningful thing to do. And I like love holding on to the fact that we can do small things to make our future different.
Have you quit?
I would quit if I was subscribed.
There you go. Ben, what about for you?
We've talked a lot today about things that are difficult in this country. There's also a lot to celebrate. I showed my kids The Castle, the movie The Castle, for the first time on the weekend, and they absolutely fell in love with this little snippet of Australiana, and I'd forgotten just how charming a film it is. And now my daughter responds to almost any question with, tell him he's dreaming. So those little things, I like, you know, the kids are all right.
It holds up, that movie.
It really does.
Oh, the Serenity.
Exactly. Precisely right.
Mike, what about you?
So I went to see a very, very different movie at the weekend, but also a quite brilliant and very, very devastating one called Mr. Nobody Against Putin. It's about this guy who lives in this town in the Urals, the grimmest industrial Russian town you can imagine, where the life expectancy is 38, apparently. His job is to be the events coordinator in a school. So that involved him videoing a lot of events. When Russia invaded Ukraine, he kept doing his job, videoing people. And as the sort of propaganda intensified that the school was meant to teach the kids, he kept videoing the classes. He videoed some of the teachers who agreed with that propaganda, others who didn't, and then kind of surreptitiously smuggled the footage out to a documentary maker based in Denmark. It's in contention for an Oscar. I hope it wins an Oscar. Honestly, my God, it is the most moving, incredible movie. And, yeah, sorry, I'm getting emotional just thinking about it. But
yeah,
He's like this sort of, it's called Mr. Nobody, and he's like the most obscure guy in this most obscure town and with a very regular job, but he just kind of found a way to, yeah, to make a point.
Well, just to lower the tone, I'm sorry to have to follow that. My thing I couldn't get out of my head this week was also Oscar-related, but about as dumb as it gets. It was Timothée Chalamet single-handedly destroying his own Oscar campaign this week with an offhand comment that he made about ballet and opera, referring to them in an interview as two art forms that, quote, nobody cares about this anymore, which sort of seemed to galvanize opera lovers and ballet lovers across the world. It went viral on social media. It's just kind of incredible because he was regarded as the Oscar frontrunner this year for his role in Mardi Supreme. And now he really seems to be persona non grata among artists in the film community. So
what a stupid thing to say.
I mean,
I'm not going to sit here and defend opera. Some of it is incredibly boring. But ballet,
I know,
it's magic.
And maybe this is why young men never win Best Actor, because they can't keep their mouths shut. But anyway, we might have to leave it there. If you want to get in touch with the full story, or if you have a question for us, you can reach us at australia.fullstory@theguardian.com. Thank you for being on the pod this week, Mike.
Thanks, and I'm with Timothy.
Oh, Mike.
Thank you, Gab.
Thanks, Joe.
And thank you, Ben.
Been a joy. Thanks.